As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
I went on a retreat, and actually it was with four guys who I never met before. They came across from your area, from Vancouver, and they came across and we had a great time in the north of Scotland. We did minimalist hiking, which is, it was all the way across to Scotland. It was incredible. So it was five of us plus the instructor in this remote house in the middle of the Scottish Highlands. We did minimalist hiking, so we went up a mountain in a pair of shorts and nothing else, just hiking boots. We did cold water immersions in the rivers and the lochs, and it was amazing, it was incredible. And then I continued my practice, and then lockdown happened, and
the seven chakras, swirling vortices of energy, positioned throughout our body from the base of the spine to the crown of the head. For thousands of years, this ancient wisdom has been passed on from master to disciple. What are the functions of these energy centers? And could these chakras help you unlock your destiny and find your true purpose? Welcome to My Seven Chakras, and now, your host, Aditya Jai Kumar.
What's up, Action Tribe? AJ here, host and founder of My Seven Chakras, mysevenchakras.com, the show where we help you calm your mind, relax your nervous system, and experience deep states of bliss. In today's episode, we're going to talk about different aspects of health, different levers that you can pull when it comes to experiencing and optimizing your health outcomes. We're going to talk about our favorite topic, breath work and cold exposure, maybe some heat therapy. We're going to even be talking about meditation, grounding, and all things natural that you can tap into without much expense at all. Because for the most part, nature is available to a lot of us, and basically giving you some inspiration, some motivation, some encouragement in terms of how you can become more healthy in 2023, but also experience more bliss, more joy, and realize your goals and your visions for this year. So I am really excited for this particular interview. So make sure that you stay till the very end. And also, if you like this episode, make sure that you subscribe, hit follow or hit the plus button on your device, because that will ensure that you do not miss out on any future episodes, because we keep releasing new episodes and some of you don't get it because you are listening to the episode, but you're not subscribed. And make sure you share this episode with friends, family, anyone that could use this information. Just let them know. All right. With that being said, let's bring on our special guest for today, Nigel McCollin. Nigel is a health and wellness coach who specializes in educating and empowering people into making positive changes with their lifestyle for the benefit of their overall health and well-being. Nigel has worked with clients looking to improve their health and wellness for over 20 years, becoming self-employed in 2000 with an initial business as a personal trainer and remedial Pilates teacher. He has grown his business to include intrinsic biomechanics coaching, sports and remedial massage therapy, strength and conditioning coaching, primal health coaching, and soma breathwork meditation as well. And we're going to cover some of these topics on today's episode. And I sense that these are topics and themes that you in your life are very excited to explore as well. So before going any further, Nigel, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Yes. Big thank you for having me here. It's really, really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're very welcome. Thanks for joining me on my show. And, I'm not sure if you've listened to any of our previous episodes, but typically we begin each and every episode with the inception. In other words, where were you born and brought up and what was your childhood like?
Oh, that's good. Yeah, great question to start off with, isn't it? Yeah, I was born in Edinburgh, in Scotland, in the capital. And we initially lived in Nigeria for 3 years after that. So we moved out to Nigeria not long after I was born. My dad was a quantity chartered surveyor working with the roads department and network in Nigeria. Spent 3 years of my life there. I can't remember a huge amount about it. And then we came back from Nigeria and moved into a town just outside Edinburgh. I was there for quite a few years, and at least until my early teenage years, to when I moved down to where I am still staying now, in a place called Gullen, which is right on the coast in the countryside. And as a child growing up with the beach on your doorstep and lots of free space and not in a city, it was a massive change, massive shift for me. Small classes at my local school, there were maybe 25 of us in a classroom, and it was a really small network, but a really close group of friends and people together. It was a great childhood. I have an older brother who now lives down in England, down in Cheltenham, down south, and we are still very close. And I have a family now in Gullen. It's still the same place I was brought up in. I'm married to my wife Alice, and we have two kids, an 18-year-old and a 14-year-old, and two dogs. One's called Mia and one's called Archie. And we have a really good life here, especially in the last 2 years. That has been very much highlighted how lucky we are to be living with such free open space, especially during the COVID pandemics and lockdowns, that we had all that accessible on our doorstep just to go out and venture down to the beach and out into the countryside whenever we wanted to. We weren't locked up in a city. So I have a really, really good life here. I love my life, as we say as Soma Breath instructors. And I'm really, really happy at the moment. That's me kind of in a nutshell there.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I know Edinburgh is in Scotland, right? But the current city that you are in, is that in Scotland as well?
Yeah, so it's not a city. It's 20 miles east of Edinburgh, down the coast from Edinburgh. So we're near, we're quite near the border. We're probably an hour of driving away from the border between Scotland and England, but very much very much Scottish. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. So for somebody who has not been to England, not been to Scotland, how high level would you say is Scotland different from England? This is for somebody who, has listened to our show. What would you say is sort of the noticeable shifts between maybe the culture of Scotland versus England? Anything that comes to your mind?
Ooh. there's always been a bit of old school rivalry between the Scottish and the English. You know, it's in Scotland we call the English the old enemy. There's been a long running kind of love hate relationship with the English. Let's say that. So culturally, we are quite different. As a kind of health and wellness expert or specialist, I don't drink and I don't obviously smoke and anything along those lines. But there can be quite a big drinking culture in Scotland. So, you know, it's the home of whiskey and various other sort of drinks. But so I don't take part in any of that, which, you know, is probably a bit unusual for a Scotsman to not drink whiskey. But yeah, we're in the same island, you know, we're Scotland and England are on the same island, but we are culturally quite different. The weather's different, the people are different, we speak differently, you know, but we come under the same flag, you know.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So how's the weather different? Because is it more more rains, more boggy? I've heard there are a lot of bogs up north, right, in terms of like marshlands, a little bit.
You can drive up from England and you get near the border, usually around about, you know, Newcastle, approaching Scotland, and you can turn a corner and you hit this wall of mist and fog, and it's not there all the time, but you're often reminded that you're now back in Scotland because the weather changes quite drastically. And obviously the further north you go in Scotland, there's a lot more hills. So we do get a lot of snow up there. And yes, you're right, there are a lot of moors, as we call them, which are boggy wetlands where they're like sinkholes, apparently. They contain a lot of water. They absorb a lot of carbon dioxide. So they're actually hugely beneficial to the ecosystem round about Scotland. So as you go further north, there's less population, less towns and villages, and more open land with mountain regions, moors and bogs and so on. And if you go up north, you can A, not see anybody for quite a long time because it is so sparsely populated, but you can also have some amazing, truly beautiful scenery the further north you go. Some of the beaches on the west coast of north of Scotland, you could be in a Caribbean island because the sand is white and the water is crystal clear blue. So it's beautiful. Yeah. You should come over.
Wow. yeah, for sure. I definitely, from the looks of it and from the sounds of it, I do want to make a trip to Scotland for sure. I'm sure I'd like outdoors and, like you pointed out, the ocean and the breeze and the changing weather. That's really, really interesting. So when you were growing up, what was your first job like?
My first
were you,
job?
Did you go straight away into health and wellness, or were you doing something else?
No. What was that like? I think most people most teenagers in our village that I stay in, when we're of a certain age, we were encouraged to do a paper round. Do you know what that is? That's when you're delivering newspaper to people's letterboxes, mailboxes. And that was my first job, was a paper boy. And that gave you a little bit of money, a little bit of cash to spend through the week. And it was great. It was a little introduction into, you know, you had to put in some work. So you had to get up early in the morning to get the paper deliveries done before you went out to school. So a wee bit of discipline. It was a nice introduction to the working life.
Nice. And so at what point did you decide to go down the route of health and wellness and become a coach / instructor in that area? When did that happen?
When I was at secondary school, so high school, so that's my years between the ages of 12 to 17. Our qualifications were called hires in those days. So as you got near the end of your school term, you did these higher level qualifications. And I took biology as a subject in higher. And I struggled with it, really struggled with it. So I got one-to-one tuition from a family friend who was a biology lecturer. And it just opened up this big part of me that I all of a sudden realized that I I really, really liked it. And it really started to resonate and I started to absorb the work. So when I left school, the natural progression for me was to probably do a degree or some university or college work in biology. So I went into biology at university, and actually after a year I dropped out of that course because I didn't like the balance of biology and chemistry. But I'd opened up this more in my head of I like finding out about systems in the body. I like the science behind everything, and obviously I've got that science sort of brain that just, again, it just resonated. So that kind of led me from there, dropping out of university with a taste of what I was wanting to do. And it wasn't until, well, I went to work for 3 years in sports and community development. And that gave me a taste for the science, the biology, mixing and matching it with development of strength, of speed, of endurance, whatever it was, of working in a gym. And then I returned back to university after that to further develop my skills. And that's when I became qualified in sports coaching and sport development, which is, you know, led me on then to becoming self-employed and start my own business in that field.
And one of the things you specialize in is primal health coaching, right?
Yeah.
So what does that entail?
Primal health coaching is, the founder is a guy called Mark Sisson. And he was looking at modern day lifestyles, diets, and why are we still getting sick, even though our modern day, we should be advancing in our health. We have so much accessible to us now, but actually there's been a decline. Diabetes is on the rise. You know, people are actually getting more obese than they were, say, 50 years ago. So Mark Sisson was looking at the paradigm and the current dietary and lifestyle analysis and seeing what's gone wrong here. Where did this, why did we start to decline in health and wellness? So he's taking sort of, you know, anthropological evidence from primal hunter and gatherers. What did they eat? How did they move? How did they sleep? And taking all that information and applying that to a more modern day approach. So you have three basic principles: that you are avoiding grains, you're avoiding seed oils or industrial seed oils like sunflower, you had canola oil, and any ones that have gone through an extraction process with heat that can cause further inflammation in your body, and no sugar and processed foods. So if you're abiding by those three main goals, then you're eliminating a lot of the modern day influences that are potentially causing a lot more of these issues with our health. So grains were introduced, the idea is, and the science says that they were introduced 15,000 years ago, and from then things have started to slow decline. Take out the grains and you've got more of a primal lifestyle, diet, and, you know, overall well-being. And take out the industrial seed oils, because they wouldn't have been around 15,000 years ago. It's you know, there's a bit of animal products, you know, meat, and so there's the vegan world wouldn't agree with this approach, but that's you know, it's still very you can still debate it whether or not we ate meat when we were hunter gatherers. But that's the primal health coaching, basically the mindset in that one conversation there.
Got it. And yeah, along those very same lines, what is your definition of health? I know there are different ways that a person can assess, but to you, what is health?
Yeah, I often ask my clients, I'll say to them, are you thriving? All right, you've got this lifestyle that you live. Are you thriving? Do you wake up in the morning and feel, yes, I'm ready to go? You know, I've lust for life. I'm loving what I'm doing. I feel I've got, you know, a good amount of energy. I'm sleeping well. You know, testosterone, whatever, you know, hormone production is there. you're not got any obvious signs of this sort of degenerative cascade. You know, you're not abnormally graying. You've not got a big belly. You know, are you thriving on what you're currently doing for your health and wellness? Because if you're not thriving, then something is probably out of balance. Yeah. So health is, although it's a very individualized for yourself, you know, do you have that thrive and that thirst for life? Because if you don't, then you may be needing to change something in that system, in those choices that you're making in your life. That would probably be my idea of health.
Got it. So you personally, do you have grains, or have you eliminated grains from your diet, or do you do sometimes grains?
I definitely don't do wheat. I think wheat has been tampered with so much that even in the last 30, 40 years, wheat has changed so much. It's now smaller. It's got two heads instead of one. You know, no wonder there are problems coming from wheat consumption, inflammatory. People are choosing gluten-free lifestyles. So I don't have wheat. The only grain I may have now and again would be a small amount of rice and a small amount of oats. Okay. Primal Health allows a little bit of flexibility because oats can be beneficial for some people in a small dose, and so can rice. So if you boil rice and put it in a fridge and then let it cool down, it's actually very prebiotic. It contains a lot of the energy or the food that a probiotic bacteria needs to thrive in your gut. So a small amount of cooked boiled white rice can be beneficial. So can oats as well. But definitely the harder grains, I never touch. I don't eat bread. I don't eat pasta. Stay away from those harder ones. Some you can get away with, some you can't. But again, each person's individual microbiome is completely unique to them. So Adita, your insulin could spike if you have a bowl of oats, and then you spend 3 or 4 hours with elevated glucose levels because your body can't deal with it. I could have a bowl of oats and my insulin levels would spike and then return back to normal within 45 minutes, which is fine. You know, I could probably get away with a little bit of that, but not much. Whereas yourself, if that was the case, 3 or 4 hours at the level of pre-diabetic level is not healthy. So it is very individualized. So there is a bit of trial and error, but definitely wheat, the harder grains are for me and should be the majority of people, should be out of your diet.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, that's very true. I'm noticing also that health is very individualized, right? Like if you think about our primal ancestors, they were from different parts of the world. Some of them maybe thrived on more of a meat-based diet. Some of them probably thrived on more of a vegetarian-based diet. And because our ancestors have been on that diet for such a long time, all of a sudden, because of globalization today, if somebody automatically, because of what they see on the news, switch to a predominantly vegan diet, they might have issues. On the other side, somebody who has traditionally had only vegetarian, they have a lot of beef and other types of red meats, they might have issues. And so I see where you come from in terms of health being a very individualized approach. Also, I noticed that some people have 2-3 coffees during the day, and it doesn't affect them that much. Whereas some people, if they have one coffee after 2 p.m., they get the jitters all of a sudden, and they're not able to focus and things like that. And even with sleep, some people are like heavy sleepers.
Yep.
Whereas some people, even there's a slight noise outside the window and they wake up and then they, you know, find it hard to sleep again. So I totally get where you're coming from.
No, you're absolutely 100%, 100% right there. And I think there has to be that metabolic flexibility there that, you know, you're not one size fits all. And I think the dairy is a big, dairy is a big example of that. Because the further away you migrated away from the warmer parts of the world, like the central, you know, Ethiopian area, as you moved further and further away, you needed to have something that would have kept you alive through the winter, maybe in the snowy areas. So they found that some of the nomadic herders live in Finland and other parts of Asia as well. They were able to keep producing lactase past 7 years old. So lactase is what is used to break down lactose, which is the predominant sugar in milk. If you didn't have that, you couldn't break down lactose. You'd get ill and you'd probably die in those days. Whereas as the years went on, these nomadic herders, the children that were born were evolving with a genetic adaptation, which allowed them to keep producing lactase beyond their 7 years old. So they kept having the ability to digest milk, proteins, and lactose as they went older and later on in their life. So there's an example of some people can tolerate dairy because of their ancestry and their migratory pathways that they followed when they were hunter-gatherers, but some people can't tolerate dairy. It's interesting stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. It's very, very interesting. And it's interesting how, if somebody, maybe if it's an influencer, finds out that they have issues with consuming milk, all of a sudden they share the word and everyone feels as if they should be eliminating milk or dairy from their diet. And it's true to a certain extent. I remember when I was in India, I used to have a lot of milk, mainly because, you know, if you look at, news and advertisements, they keep promoting milk as a way to build health. They say it's essential. And that's how the grandparents also tell you because of seeing what is on television, that milk is good for you. So I used to have milk, but I used to notice that I would have a perennial cold. Like my nose was always, I would have the sniffles all the time. And people used to notice this. And I still remember telling them that I have a perennial cold. When I came to Canada, I stopped drinking milk in the morning. And I stopped having the cereals a lot in the morning. And I noticed that all of a sudden, I don't have those sniffles anymore. And then maybe about a year back, I just for the sake of nostalgia, I got some milk and some cereal just to remind myself of the old days. And I had it for a couple of days and all of a sudden I had the sniffles again, which proved that it was the milk that was creating this inflammation in my nose. And so I stopped it and I don't have that anymore. Right.
It's excessive mucus production. Yeah,
your
body's having to deal with the milk. Yeah, that's a bit of a classic example of your self experimentation, isn't it?
Yeah,
where that produced a great result.
Yeah. So when you look at an individual, or maybe if you look at yourself as well, over the years, what are some levers that you have experienced, experimented with, or found out that really help when it comes to achieving better health outcomes?
Yeah, I've always been first and foremost, let's experiment on myself before I put this out to the outside world. So the big shift was when I gave up the greens. That was before I was a primal health coach. That was Several years spent going to lectures at conferences and hearing what other people were doing. The lecturer would stand up and say that they've taken out grains out of their diet, or they've taken out this out of their diet, but they've introduced this to their diet and they've had some benefits. So I go home, experiment myself, and see How do I feel now after 2 weeks? Like you, your cold disappeared. How do I feel after taking grains out of my diet? So that was a big shift to me. But I found that if I took something out, for grains, for instance, I'd often be looking for something to replace it. So I'd buy a product that was deemed as being healthy. You know, it was just a substitute. And actually, it was not any more healthy than, it was still as unhealthy as the grains itself. They'd taken out something and put something else in return. So until you actually strip it back and strip it back until you find out, you know, what is the essence, what is the source of good health and nourishment through diet, and then you look at it, it's very little is unprocessed. So take out a vast majority of your processed food out of your diet and you will see health benefits straight away. And of course, the processing means longevity. Longevity usually means some form of preservation, whether it's a industrial seed oil, like sunflower oils is in most over-the-counter and shelf products that have a long life in them. You can grab anything that has a shelf life on it of several months, and it's guaranteed to have sunflower oil or canola oil as a way of preserving that food. So for me, that was self-experimentation, was starting to listen to how I react, much same as you. You know, you did without milk for so long, you brought it back in, the X, Y, Z happened. So I was the same as that. So months and years of just finding out what works best for me and then encouraging my clients to do the same sort of idea of N=1. Try it, see how you feel. You know, give it a bit of time. It's not going to happen overnight. You need to do this for 21 days minimum and then reassess it. Yeah. So a fairly systematic approach to it.
Got it. So food was obviously one that you mentioned. You mm-hmm. eliminated the processed foods and you noticed the change. Were there any other levers, like high level, that you feel that somebody can look into and see how much they're getting off or how much less they're getting off in order to experience more vitality, more health?
Mm-hmm. My pitch has always come at a little bit more of the athletic training. So how can I use this knowledge and apply it to, say, my personal training background? And for a lot of time, it was recovery. So you go to a training session and then you have to recover. We know that we have to take our recovery time because rest is just as important as training. So for me, applying some knowledge from the recovery. So not just eating better, but training more effectively as well. So becoming more aware of periodization, how I can set my goals throughout the year, you know, from January to December. How is the training going to come along? Where are my rest periods? In those rest periods, what can I do to enhance the rest period, to enhance the recovery? Is that going to be a cold bath or is that going to be some foam rolling? Definitely it's going to be hydration and nutrition. But what else can I add into that equation to help recover? So it's not just foot on the gas all the time. I'm actually taking time to recover in preparation for the next training session. So for me, I think a lot of it was coming from the athletic background and the strength and conditioning, and that there was influences getting pulled in there for recovery, mm-hmm. you know.
So when you look at athleticism, mm-hmm. Not for an athlete per se, but for mm-hmm. an everyday individual perhaps who's listening to this episode, is there any advice you have in terms of how many days a week, you know, to go to the gym to lift weights, how many days in a week to do some kind of movement, yoga or some other move and flow, you know, practice. Is there any thoughts around that for a person to remain, you know, healthy and vital and feel like that or get that feeling in the morning of thriving mm-hmm. in terms of movement and lifting weights? Any thoughts around that?
There are various avenues or roads you could take into optimizing all this. If you're doing periodization, you're going a deep dive into your training year, where you break it down into cycles of training. So macro cycles, meso, macro, micro. So we're going to train hard here for this week, but we're going to follow that with a bit of a recovery week. you could really go into that deep and look at how we can periodize this. So ups and downs, ups and downs. The I told you that I was doing Power Hour today with Soma Breath on the Samadhi platform. So my topic with the Power Hour today was on heart rate variability. And heart rate variability is quite a buzzword at the moment. And that's another way that you can monitor how much recovery you're giving yourself. So you get a score of 0 to 100 daily, depending on what device you're monitoring with. The Oura Ring is quite a good one to be using. You can get a Sweetbeat HRV monitor, which you use a Wahoo Ticker or a Polar H10 chest strap monitor. Other devices like Whoop, some of the Apple Watches, they'll give you this score. It's like your battery level. So say you wake up in the morning and it's sitting up at a 79 or an 81. That's a good score. You know your body is ready to take on a stress. It can go to the gym. You can lift heavy. But if you wake up in the morning and it's saying it's 35, well, maybe that's an indication or a sign that actually you're not thriving today. You need some time out. You need to go and do that movement class or that yoga class or that breathwork session. Or when you're moving, doing your stretches, you're breathing in and out and you're slowing down your exhalation. So it's actually going to be switching on that parasympathetic system, which is the rest and digest and relax system, which is helping your recovery. It's not just foot on the gas all the time. You are taking some time out. And then if you can recover from that, you then know that you're ready for your next training session. Some people ignore it and it's just foot on the gas the whole time. Until they get a cold or an illness, which forces them to take that time out. But if you want to go that bit more in depth and you can monitor, you can use these wearables, you could even just use your 1 to 10. How do I feel today? 9 or 10, great. But if you feel sluggish, I feel like I want to go back to my bed, it's a 2 or a 3. You know then that actually something needs to be intervened with here and changed. Yeah, and that's when you call upon all your relaxing non-gym or something that's involving movement, but it's not a training session, it's active recovery and bringing in that recovery, but you're still moving, still feels like you're doing something.
Interesting. That is a nice approach to not just checking in with yourself to see how you're feeling, but also using devices to see what your HRV is and then comparing it with your subjective experience to then decide, do I need some more maybe intense workout at the gym, some movement, or do I need some rest and recuperation before I can then go back, and attack, so to speak. In terms of devices, I know you mentioned some of them. Which one, as on today, would you recommend for measuring HRV on an ongoing basis? The Sweetbeat app with the Polar device or some other that you've seen that does a good job of that?
Obviously, there's a few factors that could influence that. One is the price, because the Oura Ring, although it's a wearable, so it's on you all the time, you don't have to stick the belt on and take 5 minutes out of your journey. So it's going to give you that instant readout first thing in the morning. That's quite pricey. Yeah, you're talking, I think it might be $400 for that, plus a monthly subscription to Oura for the Generation 4. Whereas Sweetbeat HRV app from Sweetwater Health, only get it on iPhone at the moment, but you buy yourself a Wahoo Ticker or a Polar H10 chest strap monitor and you Bluetooth it to your phone. But that involves you taking time, sticking on the chest monitor, sitting down or moving around for just 5-10 minutes and getting an accurate HRV reading. That's by far the most accurate one that's there, is the chest monitor. But because it involves doing something, it might not appeal to everyone. Whereas the Oura Ring or even the Whoop device, which is it's like a watch goes on your wrist. Again, not as accurate, but a wearable. Doesn't have to be, it can be continually giving you biofeedback. There's another one called Core Sense. Again, it's a finger in a device made by Elite HRV. Again, it's saying you have to sit down and do that there and then. It's not a wearable. Mm-hmm. So it depends what time you want to dedicate to this, how much money you want to spend, and so on. Yeah, again, individualized.
Action Tribe, it's a good time to think about in your life day in and day out, how much time do you actually take to take a break and check in with yourself? How stressful are you feeling right now? You know, how peaceful, how calm are you feeling right now? And maybe even journaling it, because I feel that check-in makes a big difference, especially if you have the practice of reviewing it over the week. And then you might be like, you know, this week there were 3 days where I was feeling very stressed out, and then sort of correlating between what other activities were you doing or what was happening in your life that probably led to you feeling that way. That is a good way of remaining mindful and sort of maybe taking corrective measures wherever possible in order to improve your overall level of vitality and thriving.
Absolutely.
So Nigel, question for your body. Yeah, exactly. I mean, along the same lines, you mentioned about HRV. How did you discover breathwork? How did breathwork come into your life?
So about 6 years ago, going on 7 years ago, the last 2 years, just kind of been a bit of a weird 2 years. You forget to count those 2 years, don't you? So about 6-7 years ago, I became interested in the Wim Hof method. From watching him on TV doing an Arctic marathon and being able to hold his breath and do a really long swim under the ice in Norway, I think it was. So I became involved in Wim Hof using the app that they have on the App Store and just learning. I was really intrigued by it. I liked the idea of the ice exposure, the cold exposure. That appealed to me because it was not that you're meant to bring your ego into it, but it felt, you know, I was able to get into cold water and stay there for a little longer, tapping into your breath. I went on a retreat, and actually it was with four guys who I'd never met before. They came across from your area, from Vancouver, and they came across and we had a great time in the north of Scotland. We did minimalist hiking.
Oh, four people came from Vancouver?
Yeah, yeah. It was all the way across to Scotland. Okay. It was incredible. So it was five of us plus the instructor in this remote house in the middle of the Scottish Highlands. We did minimalist hiking. So we went up a mountain in a pair of shorts and nothing else, just hiking boots. We did cold water immersions in the rivers and the lochs. And it was amazing. It was incredible. And then I continued my practice, and then lockdown happened in 2000.
Oh, okay.
And I wasn't working. So within the first week, I thought, I need to get something else to do here. I need to focus my attention. And I listened to Ben Greenfield's podcast. And he was talking about his experiences with Soma breath. So I got onto YouTube and I did my first session of Soma breath and was completely hooked and transformed by this approach to breath work. Having come from the Wim Hof method, Soma breath just appealed to me so much more on so many different levels. And it was just this can of worms been opened, just went deeper and deeper and deeper into Soma breath, started to get qualified, took the master's program on board, had more time than I would normally have to do this because of, you know, my work was less because of COVID, and just took a deep dive into Soma breath and just recently became qualified as a Soma breath master instructor 6 months ago. Haven't looked back since, absolutely loving it. And I still use the Wim Hof method now and again. I still go back to it. It has a different purpose, a different role, but my bread and butter, my daily dose, as we call it in Soma breath, is Soma breath.
I love that you shared about the retreat that you had gone to, along with the people from Vancouver pre-COVID. That sounds really, really exciting and interesting. I think, were they all men? Men, right? It was a men's retreat?
It was open to anybody.
I feel that, open to anybody. Okay. I feel that, you know, when men come together in particular, I feel that deep down there's a craving for brotherhood, for adventure, and sort of going into the unknown. Along the lines of the hero's journey that so many people talk about, including Joseph Campbell. to sort of go beyond, especially going through calculated amounts of discomfort and uncertainty and coming back with the magical portion, so to speak. So that's awesome that you had that experience. Was that a Wim Hof retreat, or was that a general kind of experience?
No, my the instructor on that course was a guy who's now a friend of mine. We became friends through it. His name is Alan Brownlee, and he's a Wim Hof Method instructor. So it was a Wim Hof Method organized, well, from himself, but he was using the Wim Hof Method foundation, the basis for his retreat. So it was all based around the breathwork and the cold exposure. And it was an incredible, it was 8 days. There was no mobile phone signal, no computers, no iPads. we all came together in the evenings and sat around the fire in the lodge, and we all talked.
Yeah.
Whereas everyone had their phones, we sat on our phones, but we all talked and we all bonded, and like you say, for men to come together without any women in the room, there's no objection to women being in the room, but when men come together like that, there is, you know, there's a real sharing of experiences and knowledge, and it was a really life-changing week away.
Now, I know that in certain Scandinavian countries, cold exposure, cold plunging, that's part of the culture, right? And a lot of times they might mix it and blend it with some hot sauna as well. Is that a thing in Scotland also? Because I know part of it is in Vancouver as well, or at least Canada. It's part of the culture, at least once in a year, to do a polar dip. But what is it about? Is it in Scotland as well? The culture and tradition of doing cold immersions?
I think in the last 2 years, cold water immersion has become really, really popular. Like I said earlier on, I stay on the coast, so we have cold water on our doorstep. Personally, I mix my sauna with a cold shower, and I do that twice a week, especially in the wintertime. I'm not so sure that sauna, the heat versus the cold, is such a big thing yet. But the cold is definitely the immersion. There are groups of people down on our beach every day going into the water. Even my wife does it, and my wife never used to like going in the cold.
Yeah, that is amazing. That is amazing. I found that a lot of people have hesitation towards the cold. But when people do it, they develop a sense of excitement, enthusiasm, drive towards the cold because of so many proven health benefits of doing regular, ideally daily cold water immersions or cold water showers. I do a cold water shower daily, and I've been doing that for the last 5 years at least. And whenever I get a chance, I go into the cold, ocean / sea as well, because I really love it. And so I can see why when people experience it, they then, you know, become a fan of it.
There's a book that's come out recently from a Danish, I don't know if you've heard of, she's a Danish researcher who's been researching cold water exposure for the last 8 years. Her name is Solberg, and she has a podcast with Dr. Ranjan Chatterjee, and she just answers a lot of the questions about how cold should it be, how long should it be in there for, how many times a week, what's it doing to your system, and actually when you look at it, she says that it's 16 degrees centigrade and below to get that stimulus that you need, that cold water reaction. So it doesn't have to be freezing water with ice cubes in it. It can be a minute and a half of 16 degrees or lower temperature. So, you know, people who worry about going into the cold, you know, it doesn't have to be as cold as you think it does.
But I think the ice cubes make for good Instagram photos, don't you think? Awesome. That's amazing. And so for you, what do you like about Soma breath in particular over some of the other breathwork practices? because I'm also a Soma Breath work instructor, as you know, and that's how we met as well. And I'm also working towards my, Soma Breath Master certification, which I've been, delaying a bit, but I know it's all in divine timing. So for you, what do you feel? What draws you towards Soma Breath? What do you feel it's I wouldn't say better, but what about it aligns with your goals and your visions?
Yeah, I think we can thank Wim Hof immensely for what he has done for the breathwork community. My experience with Wim Hof and my knowledge of physiology, I feel now, knowing Soma breathwork in and out, I feel that the Wim Hof method is very sympathetically charging and very dominant. You know, he's restricted to one or two different types of breathing techniques, which are going to tap into your stimulating the sympathetic. You're into that fight or flight response, where it allows you to go into the water and deal with the stressors. And that's fantastic. I mean, people have got some life-changing results and revolutionizing their health with just purely the Wim Hof method. But if I had a client that was very sympathetically charged, like they were very stressed, very working a lot, training a lot, stressed lifestyle at home, maybe drinking excessively, smoking, would I want to then take that person, that individual, further into more sympathetic charged responses? So with a Soma breath, we can change the ratio of the rhythmic breathing, alongside the fact that it's got an amazing music to go along with it, which helps you get into that zone. But as you know, the rhythmic breathing is manipulated. So we can have an inhale of 2 count or an exhale with an exhale of 4, an inhale of 4, an exhale of 4, an inhale of 4, an exhale of 8. So if we're doubling up the exhalation, we can actually reduce the sympathetic charge and bring in more of a parasympathetic break if that person needs it. So we have the ability to manipulate the ratios, make it faster. We can make it slower. I like the breath hold retentions, how there's a quick sip of air and then go back into that further breath hold, which is different again to the Wim Hof method. So it allows you to get a little bit deeper into those breath holds. The community is amazing as well. With Soma, I've never done a qualification where everyone, it feels like you're part of a tribe where everyone's got your back, everyone's helping each other, and they're all coming together for the benefit of breathwork and the benefit of each and every individual improving their health and improving their wellness and devoting and that dedicating that time to helping themselves and others as well. I mean, Wim Hof method is like that as well. But it's just more appealing and it's more aligned with what I kind of adhere to nowadays.
That makes sense. That makes sense for sure. Yeah, I think there are certain breathworks, like you mentioned, that are more like sympathetic dominant that are great, but can be done only on certain occasions. And when done more regularly, it might not be the best for the nervous system, but ever so often, you can always blend it up and have this more sympathetic, shamanic style breathwork session, which happens in Soma as well, where, you enter into a deep state of trance or maybe a state of hypnosis, or you feel that, feeling all over your body. It's great. But then it's good to also, like you sort of implied, work with somebody who's holding space for you and knows your background so that they prescribe a certain breathing technique, but also ensure that you don't go overboard. Because we hear these stories from time to time, right, where people, maybe they go overboard and they breathe too heavily and go too much into their sympathetic. And that can cause issues, right, especially when it comes to experiencing trauma and not being able to, hold it in.
Yeah, you can take that trauma or that charge head on and use it to revisit any trauma that you've had. But again, like you say, it can re-traumatize that person. You know, so I think we have to look at what current state is their nervous system in when you meet them for the first time. Because if the nervous system's not robust enough to withstand a fast Kevla session or a fast shamanic breathing for an hour, then you're just going to push that person over the edge even more. So as Soma breath instructors, we can find that breath ratio, usually a 2-4 breath, and we can reset the nervous system, preparing them for the longer breath holds, preparing them for eventually going for a faster breath work, because we wouldn't want to take them straight in there straight away. We can build them up to that. So we're gradually helping them out. And in that process of 2-4 breathing, 4-4 balancing breathing, we might see stuff coming up, a little bit of trauma coming up in smaller doses rather than this big, huge dump of trauma coming out. Because I think when you're taking someone back into a trauma release, I've heard it's been said several times that you're going back into the stress response, but finishing the cycle. So if the last trauma they had put them into a sympathetic system and they didn't finish that cycle, they didn't come back down to rest and digest, you take them back into it and you can help them finish that cycle. So they deal with the trauma and they let their body calm back down again, which they might not be. They might still be stuck in that vicious cycle of sympathetic dominance every time they think of that traumatic experience. So this gradual approach rather than this hit it head on, which you can do, you know, rebirthing techniques, holotropic, they will take you straight in there and go for it. Whereas I would rather somebody gradually expose themselves to that trauma over a longer period of time.
Yeah, for sure. Yesterday I was attending another workshop, not related to breathwork directly, but during that we did one of the TRE exercises, which I'm sure you're familiar with as well. And what was discussed was the fact that humans, at least modern humans, are perhaps the only species or subset of the animal kingdom that does not have a method to release the trauma after experiencing it. Because if you see what happens in the animal kingdom, whether it's a zebra or a gazelle that is attacked by a predator, maybe a lion or a tiger, and for some reason they escape. So what ends up happening is when they go into that place where they are safe from that mortal danger, from that predator, they spend about 5-10 minutes shaking. They shake vigorously, almost as if releasing that stress, that trauma, and only then do they stand up and go back to normal. In other words, they don't let the stress or that trauma stay in their body for too long. But humans, when we experience something that's traumatizing, we tend to hold it, bury it until it comes out in some way that is least expected, right? And so what these practices are doing again is helping us, you know, shake that stress off or to release, initiate that trauma release. I love the trauma release exercises, but to release that that level of trauma that we're holding in our body through shaking.
Mm-hmm. And you can see it as well when people do, you know, as you know, the energized meditation, we do some ambidexterity and some shaking afterwards. And people love it. They actually come back at the end and say, I didn't realize how much tension I had in my body until I started doing that. And that's, it's like you say, we're the only ones that will hold on to that and not shake ourselves off. I watch my dogs doing it when they get up after sleeping for a bit. They come out, they stretch a little bit, and then they have this big shake. And yeah, they observe them doing it 6-7 times a day.
yeah. I've also noticed, like, if you look at apes, particularly the gorilla, they will come out and they will, you know, hit their body and they will tap their chest. Now, I notice from the standpoint of Qigong and even EFT, this is a tapping center. So I wonder if this is correlated somehow. I mean, they do this when they want to show pride, but I don't know if when they do this, they are trying to tap into that energy center that then changes their state. Because if you see, you know, body language experts, they're all about, you know, different poses and how those poses influence our hormonal levels and how it makes us feel more confident. So I wonder if, you know, these primates, gorillas in particular, are doing it very intuitively.
I think you should start your own little collective sort of group of chess beaters.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah,
in maybe a men's retreat. Yeah. So when it comes to sleep, what have you found are some of the tools that have helped you maybe improve the quality of your sleep? Because sleep is such an underrated experience, right? And it does so much for us. What are your thoughts around that?
If you'd asked me this question about 3 or 4 years ago, I would have said ultimately it was about sleep hygiene, about what your temperature, your bedroom was like, what time you went to bed at, and how much blue light stimulation you had before you went to bed. Now I would answer that question with not only looking at sleep hygiene, but also looking at what are you doing throughout the day? So what do you do? I know it's harder for us to stay in the Northern Hemisphere and further away, we get less and less sunlight. But what do you do upon waking? Because when you're waking up, there's that natural circadian rhythm, which is triggering those hormone releases in your body. So you get outside and whatever sunlight is there, you expose yourself to that sunlight, definitely eyes wide open, send that message through the optic nerve into the suprachiasmatic nuclei and into the pineal gland and get those hormones stimulated to get you into this natural rhythm of this is waking up time. If you are, like you said earlier on, if you are sensitive to caffeine, we'll do not have any caffeine after 12 o'clock. I have some friends that can drink coffee before they go to bed and still go to bed and sleep. But you're not that person, which you take a bit of, again, personal experimentation. I'm not that person. I cannot drink coffee at all. So I never touch it. So throughout the day, what are you doing? Are you going out for a walk throughout the day and exposing yourself to sunlight and getting more sunlight on you, not just in your face, on your arms, if it's warm, if it's warm enough, not in colder climates, but you know, what are you doing throughout the day? Which is then leading you up to that point when you're then starting to prepare for the other hormones come in for sleep. So about that's when your sleep hygiene comes in, about 8 o'clock, 9 PM, you're priming yourself for sleep. It's when we go out with these normal parameters, this natural rhythm, it's when we go out with them, not just what's happening at night, preparing your sleep, but what's happening through the day, that's when problems start to occur because our bodies are getting sent these different signals and messages. The eye one is a really classic one because you're still looking at a computer screen at 10 o'clock at night when it's telling your brain that it's still daylight because you get this really bright blue light in front of you. You continue to produce those same daylight hormones when actually you're producing the. So the blue light glasses are great at in the evening, not so good during the day because you want blue light exposure throughout the day. Not wearing sunglasses throughout the day can really help as well because you're building that circadian rhythm. Yeah,
very true. I wear blue light blocking glasses, which I got fairly recently, and they for me have been really helpful, especially when it comes to avoiding or filtering the blue light in the evening so that I can get prepared and get ready to sleep. I mean, my laptop and phone does have those filters, but then what about other places that I might come across blue light at, right? So the blue light glasses are definitely amazing. My question is, what happens if somebody is living in a place like maybe where you're living or where I'm living, where it's cloudy all throughout the year, you have less sunshine and they're not able to go outdoors and sort of look straight into the sun or maybe get some sunlight and sort of let the body know that, you know, now's the time to wake up. What have you found any alternatives to experiencing sunshine on a daily basis?
Yeah. In the middle of winter here, and we were coming out of that darker phase for us. It doesn't get light here till 9 o'clock, and it can get dark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And if you're working in an indoor building, yes, of course you're going to be very hard to get your sun exposure, your vitamin D from natural light. So I I would recommend vitamin D, anywhere within the region of, I mean, I'm not a clinician or a medical expert, but I've read anything between 2,000 to 5,000 IU every day through the winter months, but maybe a bit less depending on your exposure in the summer. And I have read that taking vitamin D with K2 is also very useful as well to help the absorption rate of calcium into your body. So there are these internal things that you can take to help keep your vitamin D levels up. But it doesn't matter, whatever sunlight you can get, and you can, if it is light, you know, it doesn't have to be, it can still be cloudy. Your body still recognizes it as light versus dark. Even a person who has no vision, who is blind, still has a circadian rhythm. They still have a message signaling to their brain that it's light. Their skin has receptors that you're knowing that it's light. So whatever form of sunlight you can get, just because you don't stay in California, it doesn't mean you can still not get some exposure to light, to natural light. So I make a point of trying to go out and expose myself, my eyes, my skin, even if it's just my face, because it might be too cold, so I've got my hat on, trying to expose myself to that light to try and help keep that rhythm going.
And in terms of running or jogging, do you include that as part of your health regimen? Because I go to the gym, lift weights, but I don't jog. I don't run at the moment. And I've been thinking about experimenting with that, and doing some of that to complement what I'm already doing. So do you do that, or what are your thoughts around that?
I'm training for an event at the moment, actually, in Scandinavia. I'm training for a cross-country skiing race in Sweden, which is in a month's time. It's over 90 kilometers. It will take me about 10 and a half hours. So I need to put training in for that. It's a long one.
Yeah.
So I will do some form of cardio. I mean, you can split it into like low, medium, and high intensities, and you should do a good mixture of them. The stable, my bread and butter for me, is strength training throughout the entire year. Two sessions of strength training twice a week, whereas my cardio, I might do a bit more, I might do a bit less, because your training in the gym doing strength training is still cardiovascular. You're still signaling to your body that you have to increase your lungs and start breathing faster and harder and then recover from it. So it's still beneficial. It's like HIIT training. It's a small dose, but it's very beneficial. It doesn't have to be 3 hours of doing running. So there's a mixture of mental health there, getting out, getting, again, exposure to light, and getting your headspace with cardio for me. I do a good mixture of running, Nordic walking, and roller skiing, because we don't have the snow here to do cross-country skiing, so I have to use road skis. So it's mixing it. But again, as we said, Alan, the recovery as well.
So when it comes to the strength training, do you do two sessions twice in a week? So four sessions? Or you do
sessions? One session on a Tuesday, one session on a Thursday. So twice a week.
Okay. Twice a week.
Yeah,
okay.
And mixing it with upper, lower body, you know.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I've been especially off late doing more research and reading about the benefits of grounding, whether it's grounding on sand or earth or grass. The more research that has been done, we're finding that we as human beings can benefit immensely from just taking off the slippers, taking off the shoes, and touching our feet to the earth. Do you get an opportunity to do that a lot? Because I know that these days you have all these different devices and grounding mats that have become popular as well to sort of replicate in some way the effect of, you know, just taking off your slippers and walking barefoot.
Every morning without fail, I let the dogs out the back door to go and do their business in the garden. And I go out and walk around the grass every morning. It's without fail. I do up to 3 or 4 minutes of barefoot walking on the grass every morning. And actually just reading yesterday an article about why is it that when we go on holiday, we feel better and more relaxed. Mm-hmm. If you go on a beach holiday, think what you're doing for most of the time you're there, you're on bare feet on the sand. Yes, you're not working. Uh-huh. Yes, you're maybe getting up a bit later, but you're relaxing. You're getting sun on your skin. You're getting barefoot exposure on the sand. Maybe on the grass, you're getting the barefoot exposure as well. So there's quite a few things you can pull into that. But I think one of the things that sticks out there is that we're grounding ourselves for that two-week holiday that we maybe had mm-hmm. on the coast or on the beach. I love grounding.
I've also read somewhere that when you schedule your vacation in advance, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, that anticipation is also really good for your mental wellness. Because then you're always looking forward to it, right? Your dopamine hits, right? You're like, oh, 3 months, 2 months, oh, 1 month, mm-hmm. oh, 30 days. And then you find out your flights are canceled. But that is awesome. That is awesome. Now, I know we've been speaking a lot about health, or at least health when it comes to, lifting weights, our breath. We're talking about sunlight exposure. We're also talking about walking bare feet. Have you personally experienced, what are your thoughts? What is your spirituality like? Have you had any profound spiritual experiences? I know that a lot of people that do breath work do it for the spiritual alignment benefits as well, whereas some people do it mainly for the health benefits that can be measured, that can be observed. What about you?
When I did the Wim Hof method, yes, it was definitely for the health benefits. It was the cold exposure. And it was more masculine. It was more about the robustness of me being able to go into the water and survive in the cold water. But as I started to go into Soma breath, it became more apparent that it wasn't about these mechanical things. It was more about what was going on inside my brain and my mind. So I would, we just briefly mentioned the 21-day awakening journey. I've done the 21-day awakening journey several times with Soma and got something different from it every time. My dad left home when I was younger, and there was a bit of trauma around that because the relationship with him from then onwards was non-existent, very different. But in the Soma breath, I would keep going back to moments in my life where my dad wasn't there, or episodes that would come up that would be very, very upsetting to me. And I would end a journey or a meditation in floods of tears, because like we're saying, I'm revisiting that trauma, I'm finishing the cycle and so on and so on. So for me, it Soma breath brought out more of the spiritual side of it, more of the internal stuff. It wasn't about the macho-ness. It wasn't about the cold war exposure. It was about what's been going on here, what's been holding me back, what are my limiting beliefs, what are my meta programmings like? Am I still holding on to those limiting beliefs? Am I still programmed to respond this way and that way? So Soma breath definitely allowed me to deal with that and to expose myself to that. And as a result of it, I definitely came through a more confident individual and ready to take on board new challenges without this fear, without this, I can't do that, that's for somebody else. This limiting belief that I had. So absolutely, it was again an eye-opener for me.
Amazing, amazing. So what lies ahead for you in 2023 now?
I've just done my second instructor, level one instructor training in London. So I'm actually one of the instructors teaching students to become breathwork instructors for Soma Breath. That's my second one in London. I would like to see myself going further into that, being asked to help out with other instructor trainings, not just in the UK. I'd also like to expand on my business a little bit more to accommodate different sort of avenues and ventures, but all always aligned with the health and wellness road or route map that I've been following so far. Like I say, I've got my challenge in Sweden, which is a big challenge. It's 10.5 hours on your feet, so that's a big one I'm preparing for. And I like having that challenge, I like having that goal as well. So it's been a good start for 2023 for me.
Wonderful. So thanks a lot for sharing your story, your experiences with breathwork, and all these different levers that we explored today when it comes to experiencing better health outcomes, experiencing more bliss, more joy, and really helping people thrive in their lives. For somebody who wants to learn more about you, how can they find out?
So I have my website, www.nigelmcholland.co.uk. I can be found there. If there are anybody interested in Soma Breath, then we have our online platform. I have instruct sessions every sort of 2 or 3 weeks on Soma as well. So I can be social media as well. You'll find me Instagram and Facebook as well.
Wonderful, wonderful. We'll be sure to have those links up in the show notes. Action Tribe, thank you so much for attending our show. If you liked what you listened to, then make sure that you write us an iTunes rating and review. Make sure you visit our website, my7chakras.com. If you would like to experience your own Soma experience, then go to my7chakras.com/Soma, my7chakras.com/Soma. If you have any comments, feedback, or if you would like to share something, reach out to me at aj@my7chakras.com. Once again, thank you so much, Nigel, for coming on our show, talking to us about the, or giving us a reason to go back to our primal selves, eat better, sleep better, move better, breathe better, and truly hitting our potentials as individuals, as beings here on planet Earth.
Thank you so much, Ditya, for having me on your podcast. It's been great, and I've loved having this discussion and chat with you.
Thank you for listening to My Seven Chakras at my7chakras.com. That is my7chakras.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.